The Napoleonic era, Napoleon in exile, 1815 to 1821. The British watchful eye. On December the 11th, 1815, early in the morning, the Emperor and Gougaard made an inspection of the area surrounding Longwood, a sort of landowner's view of the four-mile-long wall limiting the domain in which Napoleon could wander without being escorted by a British officer. This independence and liberty was strictly relative, for on every crest and all along the roads were posted red-coated sentinels of the 53rd Regiment. The, quote, permitted area, in fact, only provided a few outings, and the repetition then soon made these somewhat intolerable. The boundary passed along the road from Longwood to Hut's Gate, and from Hut's Gate to Miss Mason's cottage on the south slope of Fisher's Valley. Napoleon could have galloped along on any of the island's roads, but only when guarded by a British officer. Napoleon, therefore, declined this privilege and spent 6 years at Longwood in ignorance of the attractive side of the island where he had not been allowed to live. He did go there on two brief escapades to see Mount Pleasant. That's on the south coast. One was in 1816 and the other one was in 1820. Now, pickets of soldiers and non-commissioned officers guarded all the roads leading to Longwood and even the gateway into the Longwood grounds. As soon as it grew dark each evening, the troops along the grounds area entered the garden and took up a position under the windows of the house. After this, no communications was possible without the password and the escort of an orderly officer. Now, of course, we think about Napoleon and his entourage being somewhat secluded. They had things, as you'll find when we do all this other stuff. But think about the soldiers, day in and day out, standing on sentry duty with sometimes nothing to see, sometimes something to see. There was one thing for sure, that when Napoleon did die, the biggest sigh of relief was the garrison of infantry and cavalry and everybody else that was there on the island to keep an eye on everyone, that they could finally get out of there and get home. But, you know, it's a little troublesome. And, of course, the concern of the British was that, you know, troops that are tired and drowsy get to be complacent and you have to be careful. So that's one of the things that we have. Now, of course, there's constant communication between Longwood and Jamestown and the fort. There was a rusty pulley system of an aerial telegraph that had been installed by a previous governor. That was cleaned up and brought back into use. So there was a communication officer set up at Longwood, and he would communicate frequently and quickly whenever possible, and always alerting the authorities. Now, the list of signal messages were the following. One of them was pretty obvious. All is well with respect to General Bonaparte and family. That would be everybody in the French entourage with him. Another one was General Bonaparte is unwell. A third one was General Bonaparte is out, properly attended beyond the cordon of sentries. Another one was General Bonaparte is out, but within the cordon of centuries. Then we have General Bonaparte has been out longer than usual and is supposed to have passed the sentries, but was not properly attended. The last signal, which was actually a blue flag, meant that General Bonaparte is missing, and that was never used. That's the one everybody was afraid of. Now, such close supervision left Napoleon no alternative but to shut himself up indoors. And he took to doing this with obsessional tenacity. The rhythm of his life, therefore, varied little for 6 years, except at moments of real crisis. One of them would be whenever he was ill. The other two is the time that Las Casas had to leave the island, and when Madame de Montholon had to leave the island. Work had been Napoleon's daily diet and sole religion since he was a lieutenant in the French artillery, after graduating from military school. His contemporaries, whether ministers or generals, all spoke of his powerful intellect, his ability to dictate simultaneously on different subjects, his habit of walking to and fro during councils, holding forth and discussing fresh and lucid ideas while the rest of his company were dropping off asleep. Throughout his life, he had driven his mind at full speed, just as he conducted most of his successful campaigns. He dictated fast, he was a fast reader, and exhausted an investigation in a few minutes. The strange passion saved him from a speedier and more miserable end at St. Helena. If he had merely been, like Chateaubriand would say, a proud genius of action, boredom and obesity would have made him an intolerable exile, and worse, by depriving him of his power and physical outlets. It's really funny, the business with reading. I mean, he was reading all the time. They made special-sized books for him for his mobile library that was in his carriage while he was on campaign. And one of the things, they would send him new boxes of books. And as he's riding through the countryside throughout Europe, he'd go through them when they came out of the box. And the ones he didn't like, he threw them out the window. And every once in a while, these will come up for sale. They're hard to miss. They're about the size of a paperback book. They're leather bound, and they have the Imperial Napoleonic crest on them. Never been able to see one of those close up. Seen pictures of them, and not likely to find one here in Kansas City either. Now, if you look at some of the other people in history, there's two characters that Martineau talks about, which are kind of interesting, and one of them is the Emperor Diocletian. He spent the latter part of his life growing salad at Salona. Of course, here's a man who tried to save the Roman Empire. I would set up a new system of organization so you'd have a proper succession, and then retired to make it work. And promptly the Eastern Emperor attacked the West, and he had to come out of retirement. The other one he gives is Cincinnatus. And he talks about how Cincinnatus was happy just pushing his plow. And for most people, Cincinnatus is not going to ring a bell. Cincinnati, Ohio in the United States is named after him, but Cincinnatus is the epitome of the Roman dictator. He was a patrician who, when the Gauls invaded and attacked Rome, the Senate declared him dictator, which was a six-month maximum period that a man was selected to have total control of all of Rome. They went out and saw him plowing in his field. They told him he'd been elected dictator. He reluctantly stopped plowing, went and put on his equipment, walked into the Senate, was granted the dictatorship, took the sword of the spear of war off the wall, and led the Roman army the next day or two to defeat the Gauls. At which point he came back in, put down his signs of being a dictator, and went back to plowing his field. That is the ultimate that is supposed to happen. And he was perfectly happy with that. So it was interesting that the two examples that Martineau uses to talk about other people who were powerful and had simple lives. Napoleon used his intellectual gifts to make his own transition from the exercise of power to the rustic life and set aside an unvarying number of hours a day for study and research. He did projects. He did calculations. He reformed outlines. He did all sorts of things at Longwood, simply sometimes for pure mental gymnastics. One of his copyists, and he would wear these people out in a day, because you'd have to take down everything he said, then it would have to be recopied at night and finalized for him the next day to check, make sure you got it right. But one of his copyists remarked that, "Oh, we're off to the wars. His Majesty is reorganizing the army," end of quote. And it's not a question of modernizing the infantry or improving the equipment of cavalry. Napoleon would be absorbed in the question of irrigating the Nile Valley, algebraic calculations, educational reform, new rules for games, and thousands of other subjects from algebra to physics and from history to literary criticism, all to keep his mind moving. And of course, he also dictated his memoirs. So ultimately, we've got him in place. We've got everybody around him. We figured that out. We know what the building looks like. We know how he's being watched. The next thing we need to do is look at his daily routine. He has a daily routine. And that's always fascinating. A lot of times daily routines don't survive to us. We have a daily routine for Ivan the Terrible, for example, that survives. He would get up in the morning at 5:30, go to morning services. After services, he'd have breakfast. After breakfast, they would take what was left over of the food and give it to the poor. Then he would dictate what was going to happen during the day, who would get executed, what mistress he was going to visit, so forth and so on, did all that stuff. Then at noon, they'd have noon service. Again, you'd have lunch, leftover food went to the poor. And then the afternoon, he would then sometimes nap, sometimes plus play around with his women or execute people. But he would do what was going on that he decided to do in the morning. Then at 5:30 to 6 o'clock, it's evening vespers. Again, religious services, dinner, and the leftover food goes to the poor. And after that, he went to bed with usually three priests reading or reciting from the Bible until he went to sleep. And then the next day, it would start over again. And we have some accounts of parties at Catherine the Great's place and other things like that. But this is going to be a little less... Well, nobody's going to get executed, that's for sure, in the afternoon on St. Helena. So we'll look at that starting next time. The sources for this are Napoleon St. Helena by Martineau, Memoirs de St. Helena by Las Casas, Cachier de St. Helena by General Bertrand, the St. Helena's Who by Dr. Chapman, and the Journal of St. Helena by General Gourgaud. And they're, you know, I have something like 150 books on this, so I could change these out and we pretty much come up with the same thing. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs. And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.